Tonight, we have, those of you who have your programs from the beginning, we have Dr. O.J. Scoville, who's field project leader for the Consortium for the Study of Nigerian Rural Development. He's professor of agricultural economics, Kansas State University. I think that's when you were on the original team. Are you still there?
Oh, I still am, yes. See, we were seconded to Michigan State for this program.
And has done rural development work in Thailand and Turkey, United Kingdom and the United States. And spent 2 years in Nigeria. Has his bachelor's and master's degree from Colorado State University and his PhD from Howard.
Harvard, excuse me.
Oh, I'm sorry.
It's all right.
There's a little difference.
Yeah.
A little difference. Rather than take any more time from his presentation, I'll take off from there.
Thank you. Well, I am supposed to discuss the economic factors related to the war. And I thought I would divide my presentation into four parts. I would try to describe the economy in very briefly, which might help understand how the economic picture has influenced political and military actions. Then discuss the economic basis for tensions among the regions and ethnic groups before the war. Say something about the effects of the immediate pre-war events and the war itself on the economy, and then a few words about the economic consequences of the conflict. Nigeria is predominantly an agricultural country. About 80% of the people are employed in agriculture. About half of the national income comes from farming. The great bulk of the agricultural output is consumed right in the country, about 84%. However, there are very important money crops grown in Nigeria. And in the past, agriculture has been the primary export earner for the country. Nigeria is first in the world in the export of peanuts, which they call groundnuts. It is second in cocoa. Ghana is first, and Nigeria is second in cocoa exports. It is also very important in the export of palm oil products and rubber, and it does export some cotton. By and large, Nigeria feeds itself. It has about as much of a calorie intake as is required for a minimum diet. There is some deficiency, or before the war, there was some deficiency in proteins, some of the amino acids, and the vitamins. But in general, it's a country that has not had difficulty in maintaining its people at a fair level of subsistence. There are only about four food imports that amount to much. One of the big ones is what they call stockfish, and which is mostly Norwegian codfish, dried, imported. It was imported especially into the eastern region. Another one is wheat. Another one is dairy products. And the fourth one is sugar. The only other product that's grown on farms that is imported in any great extent is cotton cloth and clothing. Before the war, there was quite a large import of used clothing into Nigeria, and you'd see it in the little stalls around the markets. And this was especially an important import in the eastern region. George, could I have the first map? The agriculture of Nigeria progresses in rather even east-west bands from the south to north. the three areas in the east, in the south, I mean, the red, the yellow, and the green one, are moist forest areas. And they are the predominant tree crop areas. Then there's a little transitional area just north of that, the blue one. And then the two zones north of that are savanna, which is a plains with some trees scattered around. And toward the north, they become bushes more than trees. I have indicated the major products. I'll probably stumble over this cord. The west is a cocoa area. The Midwest, rubber and timber. The east, oil palm, especially. And then in through here, in the far north is the peanut, cotton, cattle area, and what they call guinea corn, which is a sorghum and millet. Then tobacco over here, and down in here, what they call the middle belt, along the two big rivers, the Niger and the Benue. And the middle belt is a rather thinly populated area and is not intensively used for agriculture. There are several agricultural systems in Nigeria. You think of primitive economies as being heavily dependent upon subsistence and the home production of food. But you don't find so much of a true subsistence economy in most of Nigeria. Most everyone grows something that he sells to somebody. It is true that most of the farmers grow a large part of their own food. But they also have some cash crop, not an export crop always, but some crop that is traded over quite a distance. So that the most common part of the economy is what you would call an internal exchange economy. And the trade areas are quite large. Foods move over great distances. Now that I put this map up here, I'm afraid you can't see it. Let me move it over here. That's all right. Maybe afterwards you would want to come and look at this map, but it shows the main areas in which commodities move in Nigeria. The south, the subsistence crops are yams and cassava. Cassava is the same crop that tapioca comes from. In the north, it is the sorghums and the millets. Over in here, there's quite a little corn. Well, there's corn scattered around quite a bit of the country. And there is a large area that produces cowpeas up in the north. And the larger cities in the south depend to quite an extent upon trade that goes interregionally over different parts of the country. I didn't mention the mineral wealth of Nigeria, but around Jos there is a tin mining area, and around Enugu there is coal. There are a few other minerals, but then in the very southern part of the east and in the Midwest is a growing petroleum area, which I will mention in a moment. There's very little plantation agriculture in Nigeria. It's fortunate in that regard, I think, because in the countries in Africa that depend heavily on plantations, you have enclaves that grow up, such as the Firestone Plantation in Liberia. And it creates a good deal of employment, wage employment, and generates quite a little foreign exchange and does contribute quite a bit to the country. But you don't find the technology and the progress on those plantations spreading out into the countryside. It's just a little enclave that is more prosperous than the rest of the country. And in Nigeria, There are vast numbers of farmers who grow the big export crops. There are about 2 million farmers who grow peanuts, for example. And probably another 1.5 million that grow corn, and 2 million that grow the sorghums. The typical farm is a very small one. In the north, it would run, the average one might run 5 acres. In the west, it would be somewhat smaller, and in the east, it would be still smaller. About 85% of the farms in eastern Nigeria have less than 2.5 acres, according to the census. This is somewhat misleading because the amount of land that is used per farmer is quite a bit more than this. Especially in the higher rainfall areas, the danger from erosion and soil depletion in high rainfall and high temperatures is very great. And the common form of cultivated agriculture is what is known as shifting cultivation, or bush fallow. And you find that all over the moist tropical world, called by different names. You find it in the Congo, you find it in Southeast Asia, and in many parts of the tropics. And in the system of shifting cultivation, you farm something to a crop that requires you to till the soil 1 or 2 years, and then you let it go back. And you do nothing with it. It just stays there, and because of the moisture and the long growing seasons, it regenerates very quickly. And you have brush for a couple of years, and then you have small trees. And in a period from, it varies depending on the rainfall and pressure on the land, but somewhere between 4 and maybe 10 or 15 years, that land is brought back into production. And the usual method of bringing it back is to burn off the vegetation. It is a system that the conservationists shudder about, and yet it survives because it is very cheap. It doesn't require fertilizers, it doesn't require soil conservation systems of terraces and so on. And it permits you to grow a crop without spending a lot of time on cultivation. When you go into this bush or small trees and burn them off, you get some benefit from the nutrients that were in the tree, the minerals and so on. And you also don't have any weeds. The bush cover has choked out the annual weeds, and the fire has destroyed the seeds of some that were left. And so for a year or two, you can farm with a crop like corn that you'd think around here you have to cultivate rather assiduously. You can farm it with only minimal attention. It's a system that has a lot of survival value in primitive agricultures. But it does take up a lot of land, and as the population grows, the pressure on the bush system becomes greater and greater, and then you have to rely on the engineers and the agronomists and the scientists to try to figure out something that will permit you to farm and use your land more often. The typical farm unit in southern Nigeria is a rather scattered thing. It isn't a compact block that a man owns or controls. He will have his food crops, most of them growing right near his home, around the village. And you have little plots. And you will find, if you walk around the village, you'll find banana trees just kind of planted here and there, and you'll find pineapple bushes along the paths. And it's hard to see a system in this, but these are all owned by someone and all cared for by him. And the plots, these plots are not fallow cultivated. They're they're in continuous use, and they're farmed quite intensively. They use the household wastes to maintain fertility. And then farther out, he will have his cash crops, and these are the ones where there's scattered tracts. He may have three or four little plots allotted to him that he grows his cash crops on. Land tenure is a very complicated thing. I hesitate to even say anything about it in the presence of Mr. Tosho, who I'm sure knows it well. It's very complicated. It's bound up in control by large family groups, clans, villages, and it is managed with a concept that it belongs not to the person who is using it right now, but it belongs to members of his extended family who may have been away for many, many years. And it also belongs to generations that are still coming along. And when a man who's been in a village and has gone to the city finds himself out of a job or for some reason decides to go home, he may have been away for 15 or 20 years, and yet when he goes home, the village will find land for him and put him right back into business as a farmer. This was very handy in the time of the troubles in 1965, because some of the big politicians were suddenly dispossessed of their jobs and feared for their lives, and they fled back to their villages and were absorbed in their villages. The tenure system and the system of shifting cultivation have a bearing on the present situation in Nigeria. They help to explain how this country could undergo such tremendous upheavals with maybe 1.5 million people uprooted in the north, suddenly returning to eastern Nigeria. And they didn't stay in the cities. They didn't go into relief camps and so on. They melted away back in their old villages. They had kinfolks, and they knew how to get back to where they had come from years and years before. And the villages absorbed them. There was a lot of speculation at the time of the troubles in May and through the summer of 1966. A lot of speculation of how these people would manage to find food in the East. And as far as we knew, there was a short period when there was a problem of providing food, but these people went back on the land. And the home use production in Nigeria is pretty much tied to the amount of labor available, because they have land. Maybe not as good land as is being farmed, but there is some land. And if you suddenly have an influx of people, as the East did, that simply is an increase in manpower. And within 6 or 8 months, there was an increase in food production in the East. And until the East was invaded, as long as they had their land and were able to go out and farm it, apparently, they were able to increase their food supply. I should say a word about tree crop tenure. It's different than annual crop tenure. With annual crops, you never really have title to a piece of land. It's this year you were allotted a certain tract, and next year you may have another one. And you have to share with other people who come in of your tribe. But with tree crops, you get clear title to the trees. This is recognized in the village. If you have planted some cocoa or some oil palm, you don't own the land, but you own the trees. And for the life of those trees, you have a quite firm title to the trees and the production from it. The tenure system is, that is an oversimplified explanation of it. people do go into villages and buy land and apparently get maybe not a merchantable title, but a fairly good claim to land. They can even go, a stranger even, can go into a village in the West, some villages, and if they have plenty of land, they may sell or lease to him land, even though he has no claim on their village. A word about non-agriculture. Nigeria is in the early stages of industrialization. It's mostly light industry, trade, administration. The nationwide industries are rather few. Tin mining, as I said, is one. Coal. Petroleum is becoming one. But by and large, the industries are still in their early stages, with just a few employees and fairly rudimentary. Petroleum became of some consequence in 1961, so it's a fairly young industry. At that time, less than 1% of the national income came from oil. By 1966, about 5% of the income came from oil, and it had become a major export earner. Not only was it a major export earner, but it was a major taxpayer. About 10% of all Nigerian taxes in that year came from the levies on petroleum. Everyone is optimistic about the future of the oil industry in Nigeria. They feel that it's a fairly large producing field that's just getting underway, and that maybe by 1975, 20% of the national income might come from petroleum, and up to 30 to 40 or even 50% of their government revenues might be coming to them from oil. So that the location of petroleum in the country and who gets the revenue is very important to the various regional governments and to the government of Biafra. I will turn now to the economic basis for tensions in Nigeria. And one of the most important of these is the matter of the distribution of land resources in relation to the number of people. George, could I have my table? Professor DK, who was a very noted Nigerian scholar, an Igbo, formerly vice chancellor of the University of Ibadan, wrote a few years ago that perhaps the most important factor conditioning Igbo history in the 19th century and in our own time is land hunger. I'm afraid my figures are not going to be very clear. I have here the states, the areas, the population, and the population per square mile. Lagos, being a city, has 1,000 persons per square mile, which is fairly dense, but it's of no consequence at the moment because that's urban. But then you find the East Central State, which is the state in which the largest part of the Igbo people is concentrated, 712 persons per square mile. And then there's some more. There's one in the north, Kano, which is quite densely populated, 347. The southeast, which is around Calabar, it's also quite densely populated. And the western state, where is it?
Number two.
It's up here, yeah. And then they go down to about 75 people per square mile in the northwest and northeast states. The The comparison is not quite fair because the land quality and the availability of rainfall and so on is not as good in some of the northern states, so that you'd have to have more land per person. But the east in general and the east central state in particular are very heavily populated. As a result of the pressure in the densely populated areas in the southeast, the eastern Nigerians have for many years moved off the land and moved into other regions. As Professor Hooker mentioned, the Igbos and some of the other eastern people became interested in education very early. They were exposed to missionary influences at an early date, and they found an outlet for some of their people through the kind of jobs they could get as a result of being a better educated group than in some other parts of the country. Some indication of the imbalance in the skills and the training that the people in the different parts of Nigeria have had is indicated by the school population. In 1965, the North had 17% of all the primary school pupils, yet the North had at least half of the population of the country. The East, what are now the three states of the East, or Biafra, had 41% of the total primary school population. The West had about its proportionate share, it had 25%. And in the grammar schools, it was about the same, only a little worse for the North. The North only had 11% of the grammar school teachers in 1965. The East, on the other hand, had 42% of the grammar school teachers. In the universities, there are five universities in Nigeria. One is in the north, where half the people are. Two are in the west. One is in Lagos, which is right next door to the west, and one was in the east. 12% of the university students in 1965, were at Ahmed Bello in the north. 35% of them were at Ibadan, and 34% were in Nsukka at the University of Nigeria, Nsukka and Enugu. In the consortium, we've been interested especially in agriculture, and I have a table showing the source of trained agriculturists by state. The picture might not look the same for other skills, but I suspect it would not be very different. This is the proportion of agricultural students entering the four Nigerian universities that teach agriculture between 1960 and 1967. And 57% of all of them came from the three eastern states. 23% came from the west, including Lagos, 8% from the Midwest. And then you find just a handful coming from the northern states. I might say that during this period, the university in the north was just getting underway. It was opened, I think, in 1962 and was slow getting started, so that the picture will gradually change a little. But there was only 1% of the students in agriculture who came from the very populous and rather prosperous state of Kano in northern Nigeria. Naturally, because of the imbalance in training, there has been an imbalance in employment, in the jobs that had fairly attractive jobs, the public service and on the railroads and in the utility companies and in the private firms. And that was also true in the officer corps of the Army. The trained people had an advantage. Another problem that has led to stresses and strains in the country has been the rivalry for industries. Under the old regional governments, each government tried to attract industries to its own region. And they had various sources of revenue for this. They had taxes from the export crops. They had an income tax. They had money that was distributed to them from import levies by the federal government. And this is hardly an economic question. I mean, the way they decided where some of these industries went, they were rather politically oriented. Each region had to have its own brewery, which I guess was probably economic. Each region had to have its own newspaper, and this was regional government money went into this. Each region felt it needed a cement mill. And there have studies have been made of the location of the cement mills, very poorly located. One of them is way up here at Sokoto. And it was there because the North didn't have a cement mill. And the machinery for it had to be hauled across the Sahara Desert by truck. And this was a foreign firm, not American, but a European firm. And there is a tendency in all the developing countries for industrial firms to use rather aggressive methods of selling their product to a country through bribes and so forth, and not concerning itself too much with the economics of the final result. There is a paper mill at Jebba, which is about in here, also in the north, which was opened in 1966, in January, I believe, and it's never run. Fine modern mill, poorly located, and just a white elephant. There are many more of those. There are examples, not just in the north, but in every region in the country, of economic rivalry for the industrial plants. And there was a lot of criticism, one region of another, before the war, about the region not getting its fair share of public works of these various kinds. There has been quite a little discussion, controversy about the allocation of public revenues among the regions. This is another basis for tensions in the pre-war era, and it'll be one that will need to be watched after the war, because in a country like Nigeria, where the resources are not evenly distributed, and the stage of development of the people in the country is not equally distributed, there is going to have to be taxation in some parts to benefit other parts. Well, we have the same problem, and we've gone through some of the same difficulties, but we have gone quite a ways in taxation in industrial areas to support farmers in the less prosperous areas and so on. And Nigeria is going to have to come the same thing. Well, before the war, there was a lot of criticism about why should we've educated our people, the more advanced parts of the country, we've educated our people, why should we support education of people in other regions. And some region that had some export crop would say, well, why should we have a tax levied on this that goes to the benefit of other regions? The question, the most lively issue of this kind before the war dealt with the petroleum revenues. Can I have my map of the... This is Tosho's map, which he very kindly brought me this evening. I had a very poor one, and he had a very good one. And this is rather an interesting map. These show the producing oil fields as of, I expect, early 1967, wouldn't you say? And it also shows the boundaries of the states. Now, these lines simply are the names of the fields. The spots here show where the fields are. Here is the River State. And here is the Midwestern State. The Southeastern State starts about here. And the East Central State, which is the Igbo heartland, is right in here. And as I mentioned earlier, the potential for petroleum as a source of supporting public services and providing government revenues is very great. So it becomes a very important issue as to who controls the revenues from petroleum. Most of these fields, the producing fields in here, have been Shell BP, which is a British-Dutch concern. The Midwest, Shell also has fields, and Gulf Oil has. There are many other companies in the business, most of them just on the verge of going into production when the war started. Gulf had one field offshore, I believe it's this one, off the Midwest, which has produced all during the war, as some of these also have in the Midwest. On the eve of the war, there was a great deal of controversy as to who would get the payment from the oil companies that came due in about April of 1967. And the big companies, especially Shell BP, were in a difficult position as to whether Colonel Ajuku would get those revenues or whether they would go to the federal government. There's one other economic factor that has contributed to tensions, and that one has to do with, it was a concern of the North as to access to markets. The North felt that it was in a very vulnerable position. To the north of it was the Sahara Desert, and to the south of it, there were many miles between them and the ocean. They were dependent for exporting their crops, their groundnuts especially, and they have a big trade in hides and skins. They have tin from the plateau. And they were dependent upon two rail lines in the harbors and the roads leading through eastern and western Nigeria. So that any possibility of being cut off from the sea has always been a matter of great concern to them. As the tensions in the country increased, there were economic repercussions in the country. One of these had to do with the dislocation of skilled people that had been in the North and some who had been in the West. And as they left, there were some disruptions of electrical current and railroads and the airlines and so forth. There was increasing uneasiness of foreign investors. The World Bank had under consideration loans for the development of oil palm in the East and the development of cocoa in the West, rather large loans, and they had to suspend their consideration of those. There were many private investors who had plans afoot that had to postpone their programs. And there was a noticeable slowdown in economic planning activities by all the governments, federal and regional. They were beginning their work on their next economic plan. They'd had a six-year plan that would be completed in 1968. And they were starting work on the next one, which also would be a six-year plan. They were starting that work in 66, and it just very little has been done on that even to now. The repatriation of people from the North to the East was, there were many motives back of it, and I won't speak about those because I'm not an anthropologist or a historian, and it's hard to sort out just what the motivation was for all the trouble, but it's rather likely that there was some job motivation in it. A feeling that strangers had come in and had taken the good jobs, and a desire on the part of local people to get some of those jobs. There may have been some motivation on the part of the Eastern leadership to create some reprisal by calling back people, trying to get key people who had been running the railroads and the airlines back into their own region. I can't say to what extent those motives, what weight to put on such motives. The essential services didn't collapse. There were interruptions in them. Shortage of manpower has been met in various ways. There are Indians who've been brought in, those are East Indians, to drive the locomotives. There are Filipino doctors in Lagos, not a vast number, but there are probably 20 or so. And in various ways, and the local people who had very little training in such skills became automobile drivers and mechanics, and the trucks still move from the north to the south, hauling groundnuts. The economy has gotten along. One of the industries that, not a very big one, but one that's rather interesting, that was affected was rubber tapping. Rubber tappers in the Midwest were almost entirely Igbo. It's one of the things I've never had a full explanation of it. It's just one of the things that, like Italians here that have gotten into the fruit business in California. They had taken to it, and they'd kind of learned this skill and passed it on, and they kind of liked the business. And most of them left. And the Midwest government put on training programs and trained large numbers of Midwesterners as rubber tappers. And they don't take to it. They aren't enthusiastic about tapping rubber. And there has been a very noticeable fall off in the production of natural rubber in Midwest Nigeria. During the war, I can't say anything about the economic developments in the East. From where I was in Lagos, I judged that the blockade of the eastern seaboard had been effective, that palm oil had ceased to be exported, and petroleum shipments had virtually ceased. As I mentioned earlier, there apparently was remarkable resiliency of food production as long as before they were invaded. Outside of the East, the economy slowed down, but exports kept up fairly well and production kept up quite well. There was a sharp increase in food costs in the middle of 1967. But since then, prices have fallen back. And if you can believe the official statistics, the prices received by farmers for sorghum and maize and the basic foods in the north are cheaper now than they were a year ago, which is an unusual condition for wartime in most any country. The exports have fallen by the amount of the oil palm shipments, and there's been some fall off in other things. But the government has clamped a very tight restriction on imports, and the balance of payments is, they are managing fairly well. In the first quarter of this year, the statistics show a favorable trade balance of about 5 million pounds. Foreign exchange reserves have gone down from about 143 million pounds to, in May of 67, to about 90 million in May of this year. But that still is a minimum. It's enough to protect the currency. They are somewhat slow in paying for their foreign exchange, making their foreign exchange payments on purchases. There have been noticeable rises in the price of imported things and their disappearance of imported things. You no longer get Australian beefsteak in Lagos. And you no longer get automobiles, new automobiles. And there have been austerity budgets for the state governments and for the federal government. There's very little public capital spending by the governments, only the minimum essentials. In regards to the post-war economic prospects, I think that the post-war economic prospects for Nigeria could be said to be very good, provided there has not been a major elimination of skilled and trained people. We can remember that after the World War, the recoveries in the countries that had a core of skilled people like Japan and Germany, they made a remarkable recovery. Then my second condition would be that the terms of the peace must be such that the nation can really move toward unity and cooperation with mobility of manpower, and that's going to be a difficult one. No interstate trade barriers of any consequence. There's going to be a tendency with the 12 states, each one to think, it'd be nice if we could encourage home production of our own yams and not have to buy them from some other state. That will take some statesmanship to keep trade barriers from growing. There's got to be flexibility in investment of resources on economic grounds. They can't say, well, our state has got a surplus of money from taxes on cocoa, and so we will go out and invest it in prestigious projects that are not economically sound. They'll have to have wise internal tax and price policies and an equitable distribution of tax revenues. Some of the new states are quite small in population and small in resources, and they're going to have to develop a system of state aids to keep some of those states in a viable condition. And the peace will have to be one that will restore the confidence of world investors. I think with these conditions fulfilled, that Nigeria can resume what it was before the time of troubles, an outstanding country in Africa for economic growth.